Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It's the first Friday Arts Crawl in the Tulsa Arts District. Two new exhibits open at the Zero Center tonight, which features iconic images of musicians, actors, entertainers, and celebrities that have shifted America's cultural focus. So says my guest today, music and event producer Joseph Baldessari, who's also the principal of Art House 18, a curatorial art company that put together these shows. For the past several years, Baldessari has been working with documentary filmmaker D.A. Pennybaker to take still images of the filmmaker's work and produce still images. They first collaborated on Pennybaker's Bob Dylan documentary, Don't Look Back. This exhibit features images from the 1968 documentary, Monterey Pop, which was shot at the 1967 Monterey Pop Festival, which was the festival which skyrocketed Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, and Otis Redding to huge fame. Along with images from Monterey Pop, there's a second exhibit titled Trendsetters in Triptych, featuring people like Muhammad Ali, Marlon Brando, Marilyn Monroe, Andy Warhol, and musicians and entertainers, shot by photographers like Sid Avey, Bob Willoughby, Ken Shung, Paul Weiss, and Timothy White, to name a few. Both exhibits open tonight at the Zero Center as a part of the Art Crawl. And my guest today is Joseph Baldessari, who will be on the premises tonight to talk about the artwork. Joseph Baldessari, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This is really interesting work that you've been doing, these art exhibits, sometimes taking still photography from documentaries, and especially with D.A. Pennybaker. How did that relationship get started?
Well, actually with Fraser Pennebaker, who is D.A.'s son, and myself, I sat with them and I said, you don't have any on-location, or you didn't have an on-location photographer during the making of your films, did you? And they said, no, actually we didn't. I said, well, what would you think if I was able to extract frames from your actual 35 millimeter, in this case 16 millimeter, and amp it up to a 2K and then to a further 4K resolution and create a print exhibition? And DA said to me, well, if you can do that, I'd be more than happy to see it. So the first one I did was Don't Look Back. And there I went to Bob Dylan's management, who is in partnership with D.A. Pennebaker for Don't Look Back. I showed them the exhibition. They showed it to Bob. Bob said, yeah, I like this. And so we did it. And it was very well received. And by both the critics, New York Times, and many other publications as well as the general public. And so then when Monterey Pop was coming to its 50th anniversary, I said, oh, well, we have to do this. So then we contacted Lou Adler, who was the original promoter and manager of the Mamas and Papas, alongside of DA, who was already familiar with what I could do. And we did it, and we brought it out to Monterey for the 50th anniversary that they just had this past June. And now it's in Tulsa.
Tell us about this, the festival itself. For those who don't remember it or only know it vaguely in memory, what was important about Monterey 67?
Well, for me, since I've observed the film and I'm old enough to remember, there's a couple of things about it. Number one, when the festival was put on initially, Simon and Garfunkel, the Mamas and the Papas, and the Jefferson Airplane were the marquee players. They had had hits. Simon and Garfunkel had, of course, Sounds of Silence. Mamas and the Papas had a myriad of hits, California Dream, etc. Airplane had had Somebody to Love. So they were big groups. And after that weekend, Monterey became Jimmy, Janis, and Otis.
Right.
Which is, I don't know many other situations where you can say something like that actually happened. And that's not to show any disrespect to Simon and Garfunkel, the Mamas and the Papas, and or the Jefferson Airplane. It just showed you how fresh all of this was. And what was about to happen was something that nobody could expect or could anticipate, because this is the first rock festival. This predates Woodstock by 2 years. It's often eclipsed by Woodstock, but this is most certainly the festival.
And this was sort of the culmination of the Summer of Love for the Bay Area, too.
Without a doubt. But the interesting thing about the Summer of Love, and I don't want to go to the dark side immediately, but just some interesting tidbits. There's this whole philosophy or mythology on the 27 Club. Now, of course, everyone knows Jimmy, Janis, and Jim Morrison all died at 27, alongside Amy Winehouse, Kurt Cobain, whatever. But at Monterey Pop, you had Alan Wilson from Canteen, who had sang Going Up the Country. He died at 27. Pigpen, who's the lead singer of the Grateful Dead, the Dead also performed at Monterey. Pigpen died at 27. Brian Jones, who was at the festival and basically was there to hang around and make a couple of announcements, he died at 27, alongside Jimmy and Janis. So, and as far as Otis is concerned, June was the festival. By December, he was gone. So the whole idea of Monterey Pop, and this is flying by. It's sort of like the career of the Beatles. You look at all this work and you say, wait a minute, this happened in 7 years. That's all it was, you know? So in that sense, I think Monterey is the measure, because it's the moment before. Nobody knew what this was going to be, how successful it was going to be or not. There was no benchmark. There was no measurement. So I think that that's why people look back on it and they see something that you don't see today, because everything today is sort of has a rehearsed spontaneity.
And D.A. Pennebaker was there to capture the whole thing.
With a camera that he made, because that camera didn't even exist, because there was no way to sync sound and film back then. So he couldn't go to just a camera store and buy this camera. He actually made it. And Albert Maisel was a cameraman for him, who later did Gimme Shelter and Grey Gardens. Bryce Marden, the painter, was a cameraman for him.
Wow, I never knew that.
Yeah, oh no, there's a whole bunch of tidbits with this, with Monterey in general, that's just amazing. And as you might know, with Janis, Janis's performance is a showstopper performance, but she came in with one manager to Monterey who did not want her being filmed. So they did the concert without filming her. And when D.A. saw her performance, he said to Albert Grossman, who was there, he said, you know, we have to have this girl. We have to film. I can't make this movie without her. So Albert convinced them to do another take on it. And Janis actually did a whole second show, of which D.A. was able to film. And you can imagine how difficult this is, because back then, you're talking about giant reels of film. So when you're talking about a three-day festival that basically is, let's say, for argument's sake, 36 hours worth of performances, if you have film for 36 hours on 8 different cameras, imagine how much film we're talking about. So they had to budget accordingly what they thought would be interesting. So this is really all on the fly.
And as I understand it, Jimi Hendrix was so interested in how DA had rigged up, you know, his recording and the syncing elements. He was actually helping out at one point.
Without a doubt. Jimmy, who's DA tells me the story all the time about how after Monterey Pop, so many of the artists would come to DA's office and want to see the film. Because what is today unimaginable, but back then was absolutely true, these people hadn't seen themselves on film in a concert. Maybe they'd had a television performance for 3 minutes or something like that, but they had never seen themselves perform. So they were constantly coming to the office saying, could you show me, you know, what you have on me? And it wasn't them being narcissistic. It was they had never seen themselves perform.
Was it like, I want to critique what I'm doing on stage, that sort of thing?
I don't think they wanted to edit it. I think they were more just fascinated. Part of why DA was able to get so much of what he got back then was because no one knew what he was doing. You know, it's that simple. You know, today you see cameras set up everywhere on the street. There's news broadcasts, whatever. Back then, 8 guys running around with cameras and on giant cranes. I mean, what is that? You know, I had worked with Jack and Yorma years later. I was a third member of Hot Tuna under another name, Joey Ballin. And I once asked Jack and Yorma, well, I've asked them a million questions, but one in particular, I said, you know, when you guys did this record, Surrealistic Pillow, how did you do it? He said, you know, we came in the studio, they put some mics up, and we started playing. And that's it, because it was all new. It was all moving, and nobody really knew what the other one was doing, but there was this blind faith that something's happening, and we have something we want to share, so let's just do it. In that sense, Jack Cassidy with Jimi Hendrix on Voodoo Child. I asked Jack years ago on the album Electric Ladyland. There's a live version of Voodoo Child, and there's Jack Cassidy on bass and Stevie Winwood on keyboards. And I said to Jack, how did this happen? He said, well, I was hanging out with Stevie Winwood, and Stevie said that Jimmy was downtown recording at Electric Lady. Let's give him a call. They called him. Jimmy said, come on down. He says, I'm here with Jack. He said, great, come on down. Intermittently, Noel Redding and Jimmy were having an argument because Noel was a great guitar player, but he yielded to Jimmy's genius. So he played bass, and Jimmy was constantly, you know, riding him like Zorro, you know, play it this way, don't do that. And Noel said, you know what, you play it. And he left. So by the time Stevie and Jack got there, it was just Mitch and Jimmy. He said, what are you doing? Well, we're working on this track, but Noel got all upset, so he left. And he said, well, let's jam. Do you want to jam? And so they picked up the bass, picked up the organ, one take down. That's Voodoo Child. And I said to Jack, yeah, but you were with RCA Records. Jimmy was with Reprise. He said, yeah, and? So today, the point I'm trying to make is, you know, magic, like Ray Charles said, magic comes. It knocks on the door, and when it knocks on the door, you best be home. Because if not, it goes to the next house. So in that same manner, I think that's why you have less of this spontaneous magic today. Because by the time two singers are able to do a duet, it's gone through 50 litigators. And so the magic has not only left the neighborhood, it's left the planet.
So as a part of this project, I think you watched Monterey Pop 50 times, 100 times?
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
So what were you looking for when you were trying to create still images from this?
Unlike when I was doing Don't Look Back, Don't Look Back is Bob from start to finish. So you're set on one subject. In a certain respect, I don't want to make it sound like that was easy and this is hard, but Monterey flies by. So there's only certain moments with certain acts, and you're looking for images that really speak in the sense of what you feel the festival was about. But at the same time, you're trying to make sure that you're covering enough of the ground so that it gives you a comprehensive feel of the festival. You don't want to make it Jimmy and Janis heavy to the point where no one else exists, because that's not true either. So that was one issue. And of course, it's in color as opposed to black and white. So with Dylan's Don't Look Back, I'm able to leave in the burn, frame burns, and I tried to do that to a certain degree here, but this took on a different life. And the pixelated color, actually, I started to love it more and more as I was getting deeper and deeper into it. But it's hard to make that shift initially when you're going from black and white into color, you know. But all in all, we also created some poster exhibition. We also have the original vintage Monterey Pop poster from the first run of the movie in the exhibition. We have some an audience poster. It's a collage. We have a director's poster that's a collage. We have a performer's poster that's a collage. And 17 of the acts.
Of the images that are in the show, there's some that are very, very iconic.
Yes.
Jimi Hendrix fanning the flames of his guitar at the end of his set. Keith Moon in a triptych.
Correct.
Where he's kicking over the drums,
right,
at the
exactly.
end of the Who's set. But there are also some that are just, first of all, it's amazing given the fact that this was so low budget as far as the film itself, the beautiful lighting that they're able to achieve in this. There's an amazing image of Otis Redding. I think you call it Red Profile.
Yes, I do.
Beautiful image. It's like somebody could have spent hours trying to get this effect.
Yeah.
It was probably done on the fly.
Well, all of them were done on the fly. In fact, in film school, they actually, during the Otis Redding performance, there's a scene in Monterey where D.A. Pennebaker goes to complete white light because he's shooting Otis from behind. And as Otis is bouncing in and out of the spotlight, the spotlight is coming right into the camera. So when they edited it at a certain point to shift scenes, Penny just went to a full, all-out white shot, which is the spotlight coming in. And people study it, and they say, my God, that's just genius. And when you talk to Penny, he says, well, what else could I do? I had the spotlight right in my face. You know, so it's amazing how these things are looked at years later. Once I had heard an interview, going back to Bob for a minute, about a man in a long black coat. And it was, people don't live or die, people just float. She left with a man in a long black coat. And the interviewer was asking Bob, you know, what is the meaning of that? And Bob said, well, you float rhymes with coat. You know, so you know, if you're a songwriter, you know that when you have an idea, you're just trying to pass through the lyric. You don't want to get stymied in a certain spot which prohibits you from completing the thought. And then you go back and you review it, and you say, float coat, ah, that's actually good. I'm going to run with that.
My guest today is Joseph Baldessari. He's a music and event producer and the principal of Art House 18, which is a curatorial company that is presenting these two exhibits, Monterey Pop 50th Anniversary and Trendsetters in Triptych, which opens tonight at the Zero Center at the Tulsa Arts District as a part of the Arts Crawl and will be on display through the month. And it features stills from D.A. Pennybaker's 1968 documentary, Monterey Pop, as well as a number of photographers taking these triptych pictures of very famous people. Mm-hmm. And some are in very formal, almost on-location publicity shots. Others seem more candid or maybe aren't necessarily candid, but they're catching these celebrities at sort of interesting moments.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about this Trendsetters show.
Well, you know, not as a pushback to today's lack of process, but I have a great deal of respect for the people that came before us, and hopefully we all try to stand on the shoulders of giants. So in defining those giants, I selected what I thought would be people who truly shifted the collective cultural consciousness. And people ask me, well, give me an example of what that means. I said, well, I'm old enough to remember the Beatles, February 9th, 1964, on the stage of the Ed Sullivan Show. And February 10th, every kid in my school was speaking with an English accent. You know, that's the kind of cultural shift and impact I'm talking about, you know. And if you look at, of course, Madonna, or you look at a current Lady Gaga or Debbie Harry, you can most certainly trace that right into a Marilyn Monroe. And when Marlon Brando took the stage of theater with a bit part, everyone said, who is that? So what I look for are people that have a distinct before and after. I couldn't find a great triptych on Kurt Cobain, by the way, and I wanted to, because Kurt Cobain, again, you know, I remember distinctly before that there were all the hair metal bands and hard rock bands. And then Nirvana came out, and the next day everybody was in plaid and Doc Martens, you know. So that kind of impact, not just in the world of fashion or in the way people speak, but just people that upon their arrival, the earth just somehow just shifts a couple of centimeters. It goes off axis just for a minute.
It's like a little synergy between not only whatever their craft is, whether it's music or acting, but it goes beyond that into other realms.
Yeah, I mean, Andy Warhol's represented. Louis Armstrong is represented. Miles Davis is represented. Billie Holiday is represented. You know, of course, Sinatra and the Rat Pack are celebrated. So it's across generation. Michael Jackson, you know, greatest pop performer, I believe, of all times. Ray Charles is in there. James Brown is in there. So these are people that, as far as I'm concerned, were not just great or sold a lot of records, because that's also something I like to quantify. I think today we've gotten off track just a little bit, where a successful movie is a movie that makes money. A successful book is one that, ditto, makes money. I come from an era where there were a lot of things that were fabulous, but not necessarily successful. And I think it's important to get back to that way of thinking, that not everything is measured in financial success. You know, you get the box office at the end of every weekend. We know how much money every concert made, every film. So it's almost like we have to pay attention to our Egyptian brethren from years ago and watch out with this gold worshiping, you know, because that leads us to peril. And again, a lot of these icons are people that directly impacted me. And I know it's important to keep them buoyant and relevant so that future generations will pay attention to their contribution. Otherwise, you know what happens. I mean, Julius Caesar and Napoleon were the biggest thing in their day. Today, one's a salad and one's a dessert. So
my guest today is Joseph Baldessari. He's a curator behind two exhibits opening at the Zero Center, a Monterey Pop 50th Anniversary, and Trendsetters in Triptych. What I like about the Trendsetters in Triptych is you're also celebrating the photographer who made the images.
Without a doubt.
And you're using a lot of their description of what happened.
Yes.
And these triptychs are, in some cases, one celebrity, a Muhammad Ali, for example.
Correct.
Marlon Brando by Sid Avey, which has this really wonderful, you know, it wasn't. It was very studied, but it has this look of casualness that is craft.
Yeah, well, again, I when I saw the photo in the archive of Marlon with a turntable and his bongos,
yeah,
I thought, oh, this is a fabulous musical connection. And they all have musical connections. I mean, Warhol, of course, with the Velvet Underground. Marilyn had actually made recordings, so it's not that it's removed from music. And Ali, to me, was the first rapper. You know, float like a butterfly, sting like all that stuff. He was the first word poet. So to me, I just thought it would be important for people of all ages to celebrate greatness.
I have to tell you, the photographs of Bob Willoughby, who did the triptych of Dizzy, Louie, and Miles Davis.
Right.
Now, Dizzy and Louie, I've seen those images. They're pretty famous images. The one of Miles Davis, I don't think I've ever seen before.
Right.
And it's a very beautiful image and a very, as it, you have to be with Miles Davis, cool image of him. But I don't think I've ever seen that
before. Well, you know what? I know the photographers, or I have relationships with their estates, which in most cases are sons and daughters. The one thing about trendsetters and triptych that's really important, all those images, even though they're beautifully matted and they are properly window boxed, they're all printed on one sheet of paper. So it's not three separate images. It's one sheet of paper, and they're all done, like everything I do, in editions of 10 only. Many times at exhibitions, there'll be different sizes of prints, and there'll be 5 of this, 10 of this. With me, we pick the size with the photographer, and that's it. 10 images, that's all that exists. And all the photographers love that, and they agree. And again, it's on one sheet of paper. You're never going to see that again, and that's that.
Again, another image by Willoughby that really struck me is the middle image in the Billie Holiday.
Yeah. Isn't that fabulous?
There's such poignancy and just this uncertain vibe that's being communicated through, you know, just her, you know, her look.
Well, there's my cantina, when I'm in New York, is a place called the Zinc Bar on West 3rd Street. And it used to be the old Cinderella Bar, where Thelonious Monk was the house pianist and Billie used to sing and Mae West used to come to see her sing. So I've always had a special feeling for Billie in particular, because I think in her day, I don't think there's any singer that impacted the jazz market heavier. And that's, again, with no disrespect to Sarah Vaughan or Nina Simone or Ella Fitzgerald, or any of the other greats. But Billie is something that even today, if you saw a little listen to Amy Winehouse, or you listen to a Madeleine Perrault or singers of the day, they've all been touched by this. It's something that's forever contemporary somehow. And that's why Billie, to me, is the game changer.
There's some wonderful images of blues musicians Muddy Waters and Willie Dixon by Ken Chung.
Ken Chung, yeah. Well, Kenny, I know for a long time, and there was a club out on Long Island, believe it or not, years ago, where he used to have access. And this is in the day where you could literally go in the back door and go downstairs, and there was the dressing room, and there they were, you know. And Willie Dixon, for me in particular, people say, well, why is Willie in there? I said, well, Led Zeppelin's first album, had 8 songs on it. 2 of them are Willie's, okay? That's just for starters. And then Cream with Spoonful, and Willie Dixon just go back door man with the Doors. Every band back in the day paid homage to Willie Dixon and to his material, and or Chuck Berry, you know. So those guys, as far as being the old Chicago Chess set, I mean, they set the bar for electric blues, which of course fed itself into rock. And of course you have to have Elvis, and the photo of the Beatles reading the magazine on Elvis, I think, is hilarious.
Yeah. There's also Timothy White does these three images of Ray Charles, James Brown, and Aretha Franklin. Right. And I guess the image of James Brown is literally the day he gets out of prison.
That is correct.
Yeah.
That is absolutely correct. And he was just following him around. And, you know, I mean, James Brown, I mean, what can you say about James Brown? That there's, you see him, I see him as an artist. I see him as a civil rights leader. You know, in a time when everybody, you know, even to this day, we have Black Lives Matter. Well, let's take it back to James Brown. Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. I mean, James set the tone, you know, but he always did it in a way that it was so musical and so forceful and so powerful and so real that in a lot of ways he was, I always looked at James Brown as a healer, you know.
My guest today is Joseph Baldessari. He's a music and event producer and the curatorial force behind Art House 18, which is presenting Monterey Pop 50th Anniversary and Trendsetters and Triptych, which opens tonight at the Zero Center and will be open through the month in the Tulsa Arts District, and will be open, for, of course, for First Friday. And I guess you'll be there as well tonight.
Oh, right. Absolutely. Yeah.
You spent so much time with the Monterey Pop documentary. Is there one still image that you're most proud of?
Well, I'm sort of slighted by something that I chose, that Pennebaker said to me, that is my favorite image. And it's Janice's feet.
Yes.
Because oddly enough, you know, I love movies, and we can go back and forth with dialogue of all kinds of movies. But what is really wonderful is sometimes when you see a movie, the strangest thing will stay with you. And the first time I saw Monterey Pop, I remember Janice's feet with those the bell bottoms. And somehow it just said everything to me, with the guero on the floor, and you can see the mic stand, and she's got these backless kind of slipper shoes on. And somehow that just said Janis Joplin without Janis Joplin. And so to me, I would have to yield to Pennebaker that that's also became my favorite. And when I chose it, I didn't know it was his favorite. I had no idea. But that one most certainly tells an interesting story about Janis.
Now, was that surreptitiously filmed on the first night?
Well, they only recorded one show of hers because they weren't allowed to record the first one. So they had to do the second
one. So no, it wasn't anything like that.
But he was just so captivated. And if you watch the film, there's a great moment that I talk to Penny about all the time. He stays with her just long enough after she sings Ball and Chain, and the audience is absolutely floored. And as Janice acknowledges the audience and then acknowledges the band, she goes off stage. And just before she gets out of view, she skips like a little girl. Like, oh, I did good. I did really good. And she skips. And I'll tell you, even talking about it right now, it gets me all choked up, you know, because it meant that much to her. And I hope that, you know, for any performer that's out there, I would hope that it would mean that much to them as well, whatever it is they're doing, because people know the difference. People do feel it. Whether they articulate it on a daily basis or not, they get moved. And in my celebration of other people's greatness, that's what I'm trying to bring forth in a comprehensive sense, is that human experience, that heightened human experience, that, for lack of a better term, we call human greatness. And it's a wonderful thing to celebrate.
You can see the results tonight at the Zero Center and through the month at in the Tulsa Arts District of the two exhibits. Joseph, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Music and event producer Joseph Baldessari, who is also the principal of Art House 18, an art curatorial company, which is presenting two exhibits at the Zero Center, which opens tonight for the First Friday Arts Crawl in the Tulsa Arts District, Monterey Pop, 50th Anniversary, and Trendsetters and Triptych. Opens tonight and runs through the month at the Zero Center in the Tulsa Arts District. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
Some came along, honey grabbed a hold of it, and it felt like a ball and shaking.